whiz on regardless of power shortages, display the latest warnings about floods and quarantines. A few are about the Patriots, this time for another bombing up in Sacramento that killed a half a dozen soldiers. A few cadets, 11-year-olds with yellow stripes on their sleeves, linger on the steps outside an academy, the old and worn Walt Disney Concert Hall, letters almost completely faded. Several other military jeeps cross our intersection, and I see the blank faces of their soldiers. Some of them have black goggles on, so I can't see their eyes at all. The sky looks more overcast than usual, signs of a rainstorm. I pull my hood over my head in case I forget when we finally get out of the car. When I turn my attention back to the window, I see the part of downtown that sits inside Batala. All the lights in this military sector are on. The hospital's tower looms just a few blocks away. Thomas notices me craning my neck for a better view. "Almost there," he says. As we draw near, I can see the crisscross lines of yellow tape surrounding the bottom of the tower, the clusters of city patrol soldiers, red stripes on their sleeves, like Mateus, as well as some photographers and street police, the black vans and medic trucks. Ollie lets out a whine.
"I'm guessing they didn't catch the person," I say to Thomas.
"How do you know?"
I nod toward the building.
"That's really something," I continue. "Whomever it was survived a 2.5-story jump and still had enough strength to escape."
Thomas looks towards the tower and tries to see what I see. The broken third-floor stairwell window, the taped-off section right below it, the soldiers searching alleyways, the lack of ambulances.
"We haven't caught the guy," he admits after a moment.
The rifle grease on his forehead gives him a bewildered look.
"But that doesn't mean we won't find his body later."
"You won't find it if you haven't found it yet." Thomas opens his mouth to say something, then decides against it and goes back to concentrating on the road. When the jeep finally rolls to a stop, Commander Jameson breaks away from the group of guards she's standing with and marches over to my car door.
"I'm sorry," Thomas says abruptly to me.
I feel a brief pang of guilt for my coldness and decide to not back at him. His father had been a janitor for our apartment high-rise before he died, his late mother a cook at my grade school. Mateus had been the one to recommend Thomas, who had a high trial score, to be assigned to the prestigious city patrols, despite his humble background, so he must feel just as numb as I do. Commander Jameson walks up to my car door and raps twice on the window to get my attention. Her thin lips are painted an angry stroke of red, and in the night her auburn hair looks dark brown, almost black.
"Move it, Paris! Time is of the essence!"
Her eyes flicker to Ollie in the back seat.
"That's not a police dog, kid!"
Even now, her demeanor is unflinching. I step out of the jeep and give her a quick salute. Ollie jumps down next to me.
"You called for me, Commander," I say.
Commander Jameson doesn't bother to return my gesture. She starts walking away, and I'm forced to hurry along beside her, struggling to fall into step.
"Your brother Mateus is dead," she says.
Her tone doesn't change.
"I'm of the understanding that you are almost done with your training as an agent, correct? That you've already finished your courses on tracking?"
I fight hard to breathe. A second confirmation of Mateus's death.
"Yes, Commander," I manage to say.
We head into the hospital. Waiting room is empty. They've cleared out all the patients. Guards are clustered near the stairwell entrance. That's probably where the crime scene starts. Commander Jameson keeps her eyes forward and her hands behind her back.
"What was your trial score?"
1,500, Commander.
Everyone in the military knows my score, but Commander Jameson likes to pretend not to know or care.
She doesn't stop walking.
"Ah, that's right," she says, as if it's the first time she's heard it. "Maybe you'll be of use after all. I've called ahead to Drake and told them that you are dismissed from further training. You were almost done with your coursework anyway."
I frown. "Commander?"
"I received a full history of your grades there. Perfect scores. You've already finished most of your courses in half the number of years, yes? They also say you're quite a troublemaker. Is this true?"
I can't understand what she wants from me.
"Sometimes, Commander. Am I in trouble? Did they expel me?
Commander Jameson smiles.
Hardly. They've graduated you early. Follow me. There's something I want you to see.
I want to ask about Mateus, about what happened here, but her icy demeanor stops me.
We walk down a first-floor hall until we reach an emergency exit door at the very end of it. There, Commander Jameson waves away the soldiers guarding it and ushers me through. A low growl rumbles in Ollie's throat. We step out into the open air, this time at the back of the building. I realize that we are now inside the yellow tape. Dozens of soldiers stand in clusters around us.
Hurry up! Commander Jameson snaps at me. I quicken my pace.
A moment later, I realize what she wants to show me and where we are walking. Not far ahead is an object covered in a white sheet. 6 feet long, human. Feet and limbs look intact under the cloth. Definitely didn't fall naturally like that, so someone had to lay him out. I start to tremble. When I look down at Ollie, I see that the fur on his back is standing up. I call to him several times, but he refuses to walk any closer, so I'm forced to follow Commander Jameson and leave him behind. Mateus kissed me on my forehead.
Forever and ever, kid, until you're sick and tired of seeing me.
Commander Jameson halts in front of the white sheet, then bends down and throws it aside. I stare down at the dead body of a soldier clad in military black, a knife still protruding from his chest. Dark blood stains his shirt, his shoulder, his hands, and the grooves of the knife hilt. His eyes are closed now. I kneel before him and smooth strands of his dark hair away from his face. It's odd. I don't take in any details of the scene. I still feel nothing but that deep numbness.
Tell me about what might have happened here, cadet, Commander Jameson demands. Consider this a pop quiz. This soldier's identity should motivate you to get it right.
I don't even inch from the sting of her words. The details rush in, and I start talking. Whoever hit him with this knife either stabbed him from close range or has an incredibly strong throwing arm, right-handed. I run my fingers along the blood-caked handle. Impressive aim. The knife is one of a pair, correct? See this pattern painted on the bottom of the blade? It cuts off abruptly. Commander Jameson nods.
The second knife is stuck in the wall of the stairwell.
I look towards the dark alley that my brother's feet point to and notice the sewer cover several yards away.
That's where he made his getaway, I say. I estimate the direction the sewer cap is turned in.
He's also left-handed. Interesting. He's ambidextrous.
Please continue.
From here, the sewers will take him deeper into the city or west to the ocean. He'll choose the city. He's probably too wounded to do otherwise, but it's impossible to track him accurately now. If he has any sense, he'll have taken half a dozen turns down there and done it in the sewer water, too. He wouldn't have touched the walls. He'll give us nothing to track.
I'm going to leave you here for a bit, so you can collect your thoughts. Meet me in 2 minutes in the third-floor stairwell so you can give the photographers some room.
She glances once at Mateus's body before she turns away. For a brief second, her face softens.
What a waste of a good soldier.
Then she shakes her head and leaves. I watch her go. The others around me stay a good distance away, apparently eager to avoid an awkward conversation. I look down at my brother's face again. To my surprise, he appears peaceful. His skin looks tan, not pale like I'd assumed it would. I half expect his eyes to flutter, his mouth to smile. Bits of dried blood flake off into my hands. When I try to brush them off, they stick to my skin. I don't know if this is what sets off my anger. My hands start shaking so hard that I press them against Mateus's clothes in an attempt to steady them. I'm supposed to be analyzing the crime scene, but I can't concentrate.
You should have taken me with you,
I whisper to him. Then I lean my head against his and begin to cry. In my mind, I make a silent promise to my brother's killer.
I will hunt you down. I will scour the streets of Los Angeles for you. Search every street in the Republic if I have to. I will trick you and deceive you, lie, cheat, and steal to find you, tempt you out of your hiding place, and chase you until you have nowhere else to run. I make you this promise. Your life, is mine.
Too soon, soldiers come to take Mateus to the morgue.
3:17 a.m. My apartment, same night. The rain has started.
I lie on the couch with my arm draped over Ollie. The spot where Mateus usually sits is empty. Stacks of old photo albums and Mateus's journals clutter up the coffee table. He'd always loved our parents' old-fashioned ways and kept handwritten journals just like how they'd kept all those paper photos.
"You can't trace them or tag them online," he always said. Ironic coming from an expert hacker.
Was it just this afternoon that he'd picked me up from Drake? He'd wanted to talk to me about something important right before he left. But now I'll never know what he had to say. Papers and reports cover my stomach. One of my hands clutches a pendant necklace, a piece of evidence I've been studying for a while now. I squint at its smooth surface, its lack of patterns. Then I drop my hand with a sigh. My head hurts. I learned earlier why Commander Jameson pulled me out of Drake. She's had her eye on me for a long time. Now she suddenly has one less in Mateus's patrol, and she's looking to add an agent. A perfect time to nab me before other recruiters do. Starting tomorrow, Thomas is taking over Mateus's position for the time being, and I'm entering the patrol as a detective agent in training. My first tracking mission? Day.
"We've tried a variety of tactics to catch Day in the past, but none of them have worked," Jameson told me just before she sent me home. "So, here's what we'll do. I'll continue with my patrol's projects. For you, let's test out your skills with a practice run. Show me how you'd track Day. Maybe you'll get somewhere, maybe not. But you're a set of fresh young eyes, and if you impress me, I'll promote you to be a full agent on this patrol. I'll make you famous, the youngest agent out there."
I close my eyes and try to think. Day killed my brother. I know this because we found a stolen ID tag lying halfway up the third-floor stairwell, which led us to the soldier pictured on the tag, who stammered out a description of what the boy looked like. His description didn't match anything we have on file for Day, but the truth is, we know little about what he looks like, except that he's young, like the kid at the hospital tonight. The fingerprints on the ID tag are the same prints found just last month at a crime scene linked to Day, prints that don't match any civilian the Republic has on record. Day was there, in the hospital. He was also careless enough to leave the ID tag behind. Which makes me wonder. Day broke into the laboratory for medicine as part of a desperate, last-minute, poorly thought-out plan. He must have stolen plague suppressants and painkillers because he couldn't find anything stronger. He himself certainly doesn't have the plague, not with the way he was able to escape. But someone he knows must. Someone he cares enough about to risk his life for. Someone living in Blue Ridge, or Lake, or Winter, or Alta, sectors all recently affected by the plague. If this is true, Day won't be leaving the city anytime soon. He's bound here by this connection, motivated by emotions. Day could also have a sponsor who hired him to pull this stunt. But the hospital is a dangerous place, and a sponsor would have had to pay Day a great deal of money. And if that much money was involved, he certainly would have planned more thoroughly and known when the laboratory's next shipment of plague medicine would arrive. Besides, Day wasn't a mercenary in any of his past crimes. He's attacked the Republic's military assets on his own, slowed down shipments to the warfront, and destroyed our warfront-bound airships and fighter jets. He has some sort of agenda to stop us from winning against the colonies. For a while, we thought he might work for the colonies, but his jobs are crude, without high-tech equipment or noticeable funding behind them. Not really what you'd expect from our enemy. He's never taken jobs for hire, as far as I know, and it's unlikely he'd start now. Who would hire an untested mercenary? Another possible sponsor is the Patriots. But if Day had been working for them on this job, one of the Patriots would have drawn their signature flag, 13 red and white stripes with 50 white dots on a blue rectangle, on a wall somewhere near the crime scene by now. They'd never miss a chance to claim victory. But the biggest thing that doesn't compute for me is this. Day has never killed anyone before. That's another reason why I don't think he's connected to the Patriots. In one of his past crimes, he crept into a quarantine zone by tying up a street policeman. The policeman didn't have a scratch on him.
except a black eye. Another time, he broke into a bank vault, but left the four security guards at its back entrance untouched, although a bit stupefied. He once torched a whole squadron of fighter jets on an empty airfield in the middle of the night, and has on two occasions grounded airships by crippling their engines. He once vandalized the side of a military building. He's stolen money, food, and goods, but he doesn't set roadside bombs. He doesn't shoot soldiers. He doesn't attempt assassinations. He doesn't kill. So why Mateus? Day could have made his escape without killing him. Did Day hold some sort of grudge? Had my brother done something to him in the past? It couldn't have been accidental. That knife went straight through Mateus's heart. Straight through his intelligent, stupid, stubborn, overprotective heart. I open my eyes, then lift my hand and study the pendant necklace again. It belongs to Day. Fingerprints told us that much. It's a circular disc with nothing engraved on it, something we found lying on the floor of the hospital stairwell along with the stolen ID. It's not from any religion I know of. It's worth nothing in terms of money. Cheap nickel and copper. The necklace part is made of plastic. Which means he probably didn't steal it, and it has a different meaning for him and is worth carrying around with the risk of losing or dropping it. Maybe it's a good luck charm. Maybe it was given to him by someone he has emotional ties with. Maybe this is the same person he tried to steal plague medicine for. It has a secret. I just don't know what. Day's exploits used to fascinate me, but now he's my matched enemy, my target, my first mission. I gather my thoughts for 2 days. On the third day, I call Commander Jameson. I have a plan.
Day. I'm dreaming that I'm home again. Eden sits on the floor, drawing some sort of loopy shape on the floorboards. He's about 4 or 5 years old, with cheeks still round with baby fat. Every few minutes he gets up and asks me to critique his art. John and I are crouched together on the sofa, trying in vain to fix the radio that we've had in our family for years. I can still remember when Dad brought it home. "It'll tell us which quarters have plague," he'd said. But now its screws and dials sit worn and lifeless in our laps. I ask Eden for help, but he just giggles and tells us to do it ourselves. Mom stands alone in our tiny kitchen, trying to cook dinner. This is a scene I know well. Both her hands are wrapped in thick bandages. She must have cut herself on broken bottles or empty tins while cleaning out the trash cans around Union Station today. She winces as she breaks up some frozen corn kernels with the flat edge of a knife. Her injured hands tremble. "Stop, Mom. I'll help you." I try to get up, but my feet feel glued to the ground. After a while, I lift my head to see what Eden's drawing now. At first, I can't make out what the shapes are. They seem jumbled, littered in random patterns under his busy hand. When I look closer, I realize that he's drawing soldiers breaking into our home. He's drawing them with a blood-red crayon. I wake with a start. Dim streaks of light, gray and waning, are filtering in through a nearby window. I hear the faint sound of rain. I'm in what looks like a child's abandoned bedroom. The wallpaper is blue and yellow and peeling at the corners. 2 candles light the room. I can feel my feet hanging off the end of a bed. There's a pillow under my head. When I shift, I let out a moan and close my eyes. Tess's voice drifts over to me.
"Can you hear me?"
she says.
"Not so loud, cousin."
My voice comes out in a whisper through dry lips. My head throbs with a blinding, stabbing headache. Tess recognizes the pain on my face and stays quiet while I keep my eyes closed and wait it out. The pain goes on, like a pick slamming repeatedly into the back of my head. After an eternity, the headache finally starts to fade. I open my eyes.
"Where am I? Are you all right?"
Tess's face comes into focus. She has her hair pulled back in a short braid, and her lips are pink and smiling.
"Am I all right?" she says. "You've been knocked out for over 2 days. How are you feeling?"
Pain hits me in waves, this time from the wounds that must cover me.
"Fantastic."
Tess's smile fades.
"You pulled a close one there. Closest one yet. If I hadn't found someone to take us in, I don't think you would have made it." Suddenly, everything comes rushing back to me. I remember the hospital entrance, the stolen ID tag, and the stairwell, and the laboratory, the long fall, my knife thrown at the captain, the sewers, the medicine. The medicine. I try to sit up, but I move too fast and have to bite my lip from the pain. My hand flies to my neck. There's no pendant to grab. Something aches in my chest. I lost it. My father had given me that pendant, and now I'd been careless enough to lose it. Tess tries to calm me. Easy there. Is my family okay? Did some of the medicine survive my fall? Some of it. Tess helps me back down before leaning her elbows on my bed. I guess suppressants are better than nothing. I've dropped it off at your mother's home already, along with your gift bundle. I went through the back and handed them all off to John. He says to tell you thanks. You didn't tell John what happened, did you? Tess rolls her eyes. You think I can keep that from him? Everyone's heard about the break-in at the hospital by now, and John knows you're hurt. He sounded pretty angry about it. Did he say who's sick? Is it Eden? Mom? Tess bites her lip. It's Eden. John says everyone else is fine for now, but Eden can talk and seems alert enough. He tried to get out of bed and help your mother fix the leak under your sink to prove he felt strong, but of course she sent him back to bed. She ripped up two of her shirts to use as cool cloths for Eden's fever, so John said if you find any more clothes that fit Mom, he'd be happy to take them. I let out a deep breath. Eden. Of course it's Eden. Still acting like a little engineer even with the plague. At least I managed to get some medicine. Everything's going to work out. Eden will be okay for a while, and I don't mind dealing with John's lectures. As for my lost pendant, well, for an instant I'm glad that my mother can't find out about this, because it would break her heart. I couldn't find any cures, and I didn't have time to do a search. It's okay, Tess replies. She prepares a fresh bandage for my arm. I see my worn old cap hanging on the back of her chair. Your family has some time. We'll get another chance. Whose house are we in? As soon as I ask this question, I hear a door close, then footsteps in the room next to ours. I look at Tess in alarm. She just nods quietly at me and tells me to relax. A man walks in, shaking dirty drops of rain from an umbrella. He carries a brown paper bag in his hands. You're awake, he says to me. That's good. I study his face. He's very pale and a little chubby, with bushy eyebrows and kindly eyes. Girl, he says, looking at Tess, do you think he can leave by tomorrow night? We'll be on our way by then. Tess picks up a bottle of something clear, alcohol, I guess, and wets the edge of the bandage with it. I flinch when she touches it to where a bullet had grazed my arm. It feels like a match lit against my skin. Thank you again, sir, for letting us stay here. The man grunts, his expression uncertain, and awkwardly nods his head. He looks around the room as if searching for something he's lost. I'm afraid that's as long as I can keep you. The plague patrol's going to do another sweep soon. He hesitates. Then he pulls two cans from the paper bag and sets them down on a dresser. Some chili for you? It's not the best, but it'll fill you up. I'll bring you some bread, too. Before either of us can say anything, he hurries out of the room with the rest of his groceries. For the first time, I look down at my body. I'm clothed in a brown pair of army trousers, and my bare chest and arm are bandaged. So is one of my legs. Why is he helping us? I ask Tess in a low voice. She looks up from wrapping the fresh bandage around my arm. Don't be so suspicious. He had a son who worked at the war front. He died of the plague a few years ago. I yelp when Tess ties a finishing knot on the bandage. Breathe in for me? I do as she says. Several sharp pains stab me as she presses her fingers delicately against different parts of my chest. Her cheeks turn pink as she works. You might have a crack in one of your ribs, but definitely no breaks. You should heal quickly enough. Anyway, the man didn't ask our names, and so I didn't ask his. Best not to know. I told him why you got yourself injured like this. I think it reminded him of his son. I lay my head back down on the pillow. My body hurts all over. I lost both my knives, I mutter, so that the man doesn't hear me. They were good knives. Sorry to hear it, Day, Tess says. She brushes a stray hair from her face and leans over me. She holds up a clear plastic bag with three silver bullets inside. I found these caught in the folds of your clothes and figured you might want them for your slingshot or something. She stuffs the bag into one of my pockets. I smile.
When I first met Tess 3 years ago, she was a skinny 10-year-old orphan rummaging through trash bins in the Nima sector. She'd needed my help so much in those early years that I sometimes forget just how much I rely on her now. "Thanks, cousin," I say. She murmurs something I can't understand and looks away. After a while, I fall back into a deep sleep. When I wake up again, I don't know how much time has passed. The headache is gone and it's dark outside. It might be the same day, although I feel like I've slept far too long for that. No soldiers, no police. We're still alive. I lie unmoving for a moment, wide awake in the darkness. Looks like our caretaker hasn't reported us. Yet. Tess is dozing on the edge of the bed with her head tucked into her arms. Sometimes I wish I could find her a good home, some kind family willing to take her in. But every time I have this thought, I push it away, because Tess would be back on the Republic's grid if she ever joined a real family, and she'd be forced to take the trial because she never took it before. Or worse, they'd learn about her affiliation with me and interrogate her. I shake my head. Too naive. Too easily manipulated. I wouldn't trust her with anyone else. Besides, I'd miss her. The first 2 years I'd spent wandering the streets by myself were lonely ones. I gingerly move my ankle in a circle. It's a little stiff, but otherwise pretty painless. No torn muscles, no serious swelling. My bullet wound still burns and my ribs ache something fierce. But this time I'm strong enough to sit up without too much trouble. My hands go automatically up to my hair, which is loose and hanging past my shoulders. With one hand, I pull it into a messy tail and twist it into a tight knot. Then I lean over Tess, grab my beaten newsboy cap from the chair, and pull it on. My arms burn from the effort. I smell chili and bread. There's a bowl with some steam rising from it on the dresser next to the bed, and a small loaf of bread balanced on the bowl's edge. I think back to the 2 cans our caretaker had placed on the dresser. My stomach growls. I devour it all. As I'm licking the last of the chili off my fingers, I hear a door close somewhere in the house, and moments later, footsteps rushing toward our room. I tense up. Next to me, Tess jerks awake and grabs my arm. "What was that?" she blurts out. I hold a finger to my lips. Our caretaker hurries into the room, a tattered robe draped over his pajamas. "You should leave now," he whispers, sweat beads on his forehead. "I just heard about a man who's been looking for you." I stare levelly at him. Tess gives me a panicked look. "How do you know?" I ask. The man starts cleaning up the room, grabbing my empty bowl and wiping down the dresser. "He's telling people that he has plague cures for someone who needs it. He says he knows that you're injured. He never gave a name, but he must be talking about you." I sit up straight and swing my legs over the side of the bed. There's no choice now. "He's talking about me," I agree. Tess snatches up a few clean bandages and stuffs them under her shirt. "It's a trap. We'll leave immediately." The man nods once. "You can get out through the back door. Straight into the hall, on your left." I take a moment to meet his eyes. In that instant, I realize that he knows exactly who I am. He won't say it out loud, though. Like other people in our sector who have realized who I am and helped me in the past, he doesn't exactly disapprove of the trouble I cause for the Republic. "We're very grateful," I say. He says nothing in return. I grab Tess's hand and we make our way out of the bedroom, down the hall, and through the back door. The night's humidity is thick. My eyes water from the pain of my wounds. We make our way through silent back alleys for 6 blocks until we finally slow down. My injuries are screaming now. I reach up to touch my pendant necklace for comfort, but then I remember that it's no longer around my neck. A sick feeling rises in my stomach. What if the Republic figures out what it is? Will they destroy it? What if they trace it back to my family? Tess slumps to the ground and rests her head against the alley wall. "We need to leave the city," she says. "It's too dangerous here, Day. You know it is. Arizona or Colorado would be safer, or, come on, even Barstow. I don't mind the outskirts." "Yeah, yeah, I know." I look down. "I want to leave, too." "But you won't. I can see it on your face." We're silent for a while. If it were up to me, I'd cross the whole country alone and escape into the colony's first chance I got. I don't mind risking my own life, but there are a dozen reasons I can't go, and Tess knows it. It's not like John and Mom can just pick up and leave their assigned jobs to flee with me, not without raising an alert. It's not like Eden can just withdraw from his assigned school. Not unless they want to become fugitives like me. We'll see, I finally say. Tess gives me a tragic smile.
Who do you think is looking for you? She asks after a while. How do they know we're in the lake sector?
I don't know. Could be a dealer who heard about the hospital break-in. Maybe they think we have a lot of money or something. Could be a soldier, even a spy. I lost my pendant at the hospital. I don't know how they would use it to learn anything about me, but there's always a chance.
What are you going to do about it?
I shrug. My bullet wound has begun to throb, and I lean against the wall for support. I'm sure as hell not meeting him, whoever he is. But I got to admit, I'm curious to see what he has to say. What if he does have plague cures? Tess stares at me. It's the same expression she wore the very first night I met her. Hopeful, curious, and fearful all at once. Well, can't be any more dangerous than your crazy hospital break-in, yeah?
June. I don't know if it's because Commander Jameson has taken pity on me, or if she really does feel the loss of Mateus, one of her most valued soldiers, but she helps me arrange his funeral, even though she's never done that for one of her soldiers before. She refuses to say anything about why she chose to do it. Wealthy families like ours always have elaborate funerals. Mateus's takes place inside a building with soaring Baroque archways and stained glass windows. They've covered the bare floors with white carpets. Round white banquet tables overflowing with white lilacs fill the room. The only colors come from the Republic flags hanging behind the altar at the room's front and the portrait of our glorious Elector above them. All the mourners wear their best whites. I have on an elaborate white gown, laced and corseted, with a silk overskirt and drape layers in the back. The hairdresser piled my hair high on my head, with loose ringlets cascading over one shoulder, and a white rose pinned behind my ear. Pearls line the choker wrapped around my throat. My eyelids are coated with glittering white eyeshadow. My lashes are bathed in snow, the puffy redness under my eyes erased by shining white powder. Everything about me is stripped of color, just as Mateus has been stripped from my life. Mateus once told me that it was not always this way, that only after the first floods and volcanic eruptions, after the Republic built a barrier along the waterfront to keep the colony's deserters from fleeing illegally into our territory, did people start mourning for the dead by wearing white. After the first eruptions, he said, white volcanic ash rained from the sky for months. The dead and dying were covered in it. So now, to wear white is to remember the dead. He told me this because I'd asked him what our parents' funeral was like. Now I wander among the guests, lost and aimless, responding to the sympathetic words of those around me with appropriate, practiced replies. I am so sorry for your loss, they say. I recognize some of Mateus's professors, fellow soldiers, and superiors. There are even a couple of my classmates from Drake. I'm surprised to see them. I'd never been good at making friends during my 3 years in college, considering my age and my hefty course load. But they're here, some from afternoon drills and others from my Republic History 421 class. They take my hand and shake their heads. First your parents, and now your brother. I can't imagine how hard it is for you. No, you can't. But I smile graciously and bow my head, because I know they mean well. Thank you for coming, I say. It means a lot. I know Mateus would be proud that he gave his life for his country. Sometimes I catch an admiring glance from a well-wisher across the room, which I ignore. I have no use for such sentiments. My outfit is not meant for them. Only for Mateus do I wear this unnecessarily exquisite gown, to show without words how much I love him. After a while, I sit at a table near the front of the room, facing the flower-strewn altar that'll soon be occupied with a line of people reading their eulogies to my brother. I bow my head respectfully to the Republic flags. Then my eyes wander to the white coffin next to them. From here, I can see just a hint of the person lying inside.
You look lovely, June.
I glance up to see Thomas bow, then take the seat beside me. He's exchanged his military clothes for an elegant, white-vested suit, and his hair is freshly cut. I can tell the suit is brand new. It must have cost him a fortune.
Thanks. You too.
That is, I mean, you look well for the circumstances, given all that's happened.
I know what you mean. I reach over and pat his hand to reassure him. He gives me a smile. He looks like he wants to say something more, then decides against it and turns his eyes away. It takes a half hour for everyone to find their seats, and another half hour for the waiters to start arriving with plates of food. I don't eat anything. Commander Jameson sits opposite me on the far side of our banquet table, and between her and Thomas are three of my Drake classmates. I exchange a strained smile with them. On my left side is a man named Chan, who organizes and oversees all trials taken in Los Angeles. He administered mine. What I don't understand is why he's here, why he even cares that Mateus died. He's a former acquaintance of our parents, so his presence is not unexpected. But why right next to me? Then I remember that Chan had mentored Mateus before he joined Commander Jameson's squad. Mateus hated him. The man now furrows his bushy eyebrows at me and claps a hand on my bare shoulder. It lingers there for a while.
"How are you feeling, my dear?" he asks.
His words distort the scars on his face, a slice across the bridge of his nose, and another jagged mark that goes from his ear to the bottom of his chin. I manage a smile. Better than expected.
"Well, I'll say."
He lets out a laugh that makes me cringe. His eyes look me up and down.
"That dress polishes you up like a fresh snow blossom."
It takes all my control to keep the smile on my face.
"Stay calm," I tell myself. Chan is not a man to make into an enemy.
"I loved your brother very much, you know,"
he continues with overdone sympathy.
"I remember him as a kid. You should have seen him. He used to run around your parents' living room, holding out his hand like a little gun. He was destined to enter our squads."
"Thank you, sir," I say. Chan saws off a huge piece of steak and shoves it in his mouth.
"Mateus was very attentive during the time I mentored him. Natural leader. Did he ever tell you about that?"
A memory flashes through my mind. The rainy night when Mateus first started working for Chan. He had taken me and Thomas, who was still in school, out to the Tanegashi sector, where I ate my first bowl of pork edamame with spaghetti and sweet onion rolls. I remember the two of them were in full uniform, Mateus with his jacket open and shirt hanging loose, Thomas neatly buttoned up with his hair carefully slicked back. Thomas teased me over my messy pigtails, but Mateus was quiet. Then a week later, his apprenticeship with Chan ended abruptly. Mateus had filed an appeal, and he was reassigned to Commander Jameson's patrol.
"He said it was all classified," I lie.
Chan laughs. "A good boy that Mateus was, a great apprentice. Imagine my disappointment when he was reassigned to the city patrols. He told me he just didn't have the smarts to judge the trials or organize the kids who finished taking them. Such a modest one, always smarter than he thought he was, just like you."
He grins at me. I nod. Chan made me take the trial twice because I got a perfect score in record time, 1 hour, 10 minutes. He thought I had cheated. Not only do I have the only perfect score in the nation, I'm probably also the only kid who has ever taken the trial twice.
"You are very kind," I reply. "My brother was a better leader than I'll ever be."
Chan shushes me with a wave of his hand.
"Nonsense, my dear," he says.
Then he leans uncomfortably close. There's something oily and unpleasant about him.
"I'm personally devastated by the way he died," he says. "At the hands of that nasty boy. What a shame."
Chan narrows his eyes, making his eyebrows look even bushier.
"I was so pleased when Commander Jameson told me that you'd be tracking him.
His case needs a pair of fresh eyes, and you're just the doll to do it. What a gem of a test mission, eh?
I hate him with all my being. Thomas notices my stiffness because I feel his hand cover mine under the table. Just go with it, he's trying to tell me. When Chan finally turns away from me to answer a question from the man on his other side, Thomas leans toward me.
Chan has a personal grudge against Day, he whispers.
Is that so?
I whisper back.
He nods.
Who do you think gave him that scar?
Day did? I can't keep the surprise from my face. Chan is a rather large man and has worked for the trials administration for as long as I can remember. He's a skilled official. Could a teenage boy really wound him like that and get away with it?
I glance over at Chan and study the scar. It's a clean cut made with a smooth-edged blade. Must have happened quickly, too, to be such a straight line. I can't imagine Chan holding still while someone sliced him like that. For a moment, just a split second, I'm on Day's side. I glance up at Commander Jameson, who stares at me as if she's reading my thoughts. It makes me uneasy. Thomas's hand touches mine again.
Hey, he says. Day can't hide from the government forever. Sooner or later, we'll dig that street rat out and make an example out of him. He's no match for you, especially when you put your mind to something.
Thomas's kind smile makes me weak, and suddenly I feel like Mateus is the one sitting next to me and telling me everything is going to be okay, reassuring me that the Republic won't fail me. My brother had once promised to stay at my side forever. I look away from Thomas and toward the altar so he doesn't see the tears in my eyes. I don't think I'll ever smile again.
Let's get this over with, I whisper.
Day. It's gaudy hot even this late in the afternoon. I limp through the streets along the rim of Alta and Winter Sector, along the lake and out in the open, lost in the crowded shuffle of other people. My wounds are still healing. I wear the army trousers our caretaker gave me with a thin collared shirt Tess found in a garbage bin. My cap is pulled low, and I've added to my disguise with a bandage patch over my left eye. Nothing unusual, really. Not in this sea of workers with factory injuries. Today I'm out on my own. Tess is keeping a low profile several streets down, tucked away on a hidden second-floor ledge. Never any reason to risk both of us if I don't have to. Familiar noises surround me. Street vendors call out to passers-by, selling boiled goose eggs and fried dough and hot dogs. Attendants linger at the doors of grocery stores and coffee shops, trying to win customers over. A decades-old car rattles by. The second-shift workers are slowly making their way home. A few girls notice me and blush when I look at them. Boats chug around the lake, careful to avoid the giant water turbines churning along the edge, and the shore's flood sirens are quiet and unlit. Some areas are blocked off. These I steer clear of. The soldiers have marked them as quarantine zones. The loudspeakers that line the roofs of the buildings crackle and pop, and jumbotrons pause in their ads, or, in some cases, warnings about another Patriot rebel attack, to show a video of our flag. Everyone stops in the streets and goes still as the pledge starts. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the great Republic of America, to our Elector Primo, to our glorious states, to unity against the colonies, to our impending victory. When the Elector Primo's name comes on, we salute toward the Capitol. I mumble the pledge under my breath, but stay silent in the last two passages when the street police aren't looking my way. I wonder what the pledge sounded like before we went to war against the colonies. When the pledge ends, life resumes. I go to a Chinese-themed bar covered in graffiti. The attendant at the door gives me a wide smile that's missing several teeth and quickly ushers me in. "We have real Tsingtao beer today," he murmurs. "Leftover cases from an imported gift sent straight to our glorious elector himself. Goes until 6 o'clock. His eyes dart around nervously as he says this. I just stare at him. Tsingtao beer? Yeah, right. My father would have laughed. The Republic didn't sign an import deal with China, or as the Republic likes to claim, conquer China and took over its businesses just to send quality imports to the slum sectors. More likely, this guy's pretty far behind in paying his bimonthly government taxes. No other reason to risk slapping fake Tsingtao labels on bottles of his homebrew. I thank the man, though, and step inside. This is as good a place as any to dig up information. It's dark. The air smells like pipe smoke and fried meat and gas lamps. I bump my way through the mess of tables and chairs, snatching food from a couple of unguarded plates as I go, and stuffing it beneath my shirt, until I reach the bar. Behind me, a large circle of customers are cheering on a skiz fight. Guess this bar tolerates illegal gambling. If they're smart, they'll be ready at any minute to bribe the street police with their winnings, unless they're willing to admit out loud that they're making tax-free money. The bartender doesn't bother to check my age. She doesn't even look at me. "What'll it be?" she asks. I shake my head. "Just some water, please," I say. Behind us, I hear a huge roar of cheers as one of the fighters goes down. She gives me a skeptical glance. Her eyes immediately shift to the bandage on my face. "What happened to your eye, kid?" "Terrace accident. I tend cows." She makes a disgusted face, but now she seems interested in me. "What a shame. Sure you don't want a beer to go with that? Must hurt." I shake my head again. "Thanks, cousin, but I don't drink. I like to stay alert." She smiles at me. She's kind of pretty in the flickering lamplight, with glittering green powder over her smooth-lidded eyes and a short, black, bobbed haircut. A vine tattoo snakes down her neck and disappears into her corseted shirt. A dirty pair of goggles, probably protection against bar fights, hangs around her neck. Kind of a shame. If I weren't busy hunting for information, I'd take my time with this girl, chat her up, and maybe get a kiss, or three, out of her. "Lake boy, yeah?" she asks. "Just decided to waltz in here and break a few girls' hearts? Or are you fighting?" She nods her head toward the skiz fight. I grin. "I'll leave that to you. What makes you think I fight?" I nod at the scars on her arms and the bruises on her hands. She gives me a slow smile. I shrug after a moment. "I wouldn't be caught dead in one of those rings. Just taking a break from the sun. You seem like nice company, you know? I mean, as long as you don't have the plague." A universal joke, but she still laughs. She leans on the counter. "I live on the sector's edge. Pretty safe there so far." I lean toward her. "You're lucky then." I grow serious. "A family I know had their door marked recently." "Sorry to hear it. I want to ask you something, just out of curiosity. You heard anything about a man around here in the last few days? Someone who says he has plague meds?" She raises an eyebrow at me. "Yeah, I heard about that. There's a bunch of people trying to find him." "Do you know what he's been telling people?" She hesitates for a moment. I notice that she has a few tiny freckles on her nose. "I hear he's telling people he wants to give a plague cure to someone. One person only. That this person will know who he's talking about." I pretend to look amused. "Lucky person, yeah?" She grins. "No kidding. He said he wants this person to meet him at midnight, tonight, at the 10-second place." 10-second place? The bartender shrugs. "Hell if I know what that means. Neither does anyone else, for that matter." She leans over the counter toward me and lowers her voice. "Know what I think? I think this guy's just crazy." I laugh along with her, but my mind is spinning. I have no doubt now that this person is searching for me. Almost a year ago, I broke into an Arcadia bank through the alley that runs behind it. One of the security guards tried to kill me. When he spat at me and told me I'd be cut to pieces by the bank vault's lasers, I taunted him. I told him that it would take me 10 seconds to break into that vault room. He didn't believe me. But the thing is, no one ever believes what I say until I actually end up doing it. I bought myself a nice pair of boots with that money, and even shopped for an electro bomb on the black market, a weapon that disables guns in its vicinity. Came in handy when I attacked an airbase. And Tess got an entire outfit. Brand new shirts and shoes and pants, and bandages and rubbing alcohol and even a bottle of aspirin. We both got a good amount of food. The rest I gave to my family and other lake folks. After several more minutes of flirting, I say goodbye to the bartender girl and leave. The sun's still in the sky, and I can feel beads of sweat on my face. I know enough now. The government must have found something at the hospital and wants to lure me into a trap. They'll send a guy to the 10-second place at midnight, and then place soldiers along the back alley. I bet they think I'm real desperate. They'll probably also bring along plague meds, though, to tempt me out into the open. I press my lips together in thought. Then I change the direction I'm walking. Off to the financial district. I have an appointment to keep.
June. 11:29 p.m. Batala Sector. 72 degrees Fahrenheit indoors. The lights in Batala Hall are cold and fluorescent. I dress in a bathroom on the observation and analysis floor. I'm wearing long black sleeves inside a striped black vest, slender black pants tucked into boots, and a long black robe that wraps around my shoulders and covers me like a blanket. A white stripe runs down the center of it, all the way to the floor. A black mask covers my face, and infrared goggles shield my eyes. Other than that, all I have is a tiny microphone and an even tinier earpiece. And a gun, just in case. I need to look genderless, generic, unidentifiable. I need to look like a black market dealer, someone rich enough to afford plague cures. Mateus would have shaken his head at me. "You can't go alone on a classified mission, June," he would say. "You might get hurt." How ironic. I tighten the clasp that holds my cloak in place, steel sprayed with bronze, probably imported from West Texas, then head off towards the stairs that will take me outside Batala Hall and down towards the Arcadia Bank where I'm supposed to meet Day. My brother has been dead for 120 hours. It already feels like forever. 70 hours ago, I gained clearance to search the internet and found out as much about Day as I could. 40 hours ago, I laid out a plan for tracking Day to Commander Jameson. 32 hours ago, she approved it. I doubt she even remembers what it is. 30 hours ago, I sent one scout to every plague-infected sector in Los Angeles, Winter, Blue Ridge, Lake, and Alta. They spread the word. Someone has a plague medicine for you. Come to the 10-second place. 29 hours ago, I attended my brother's funeral. I do not plan on catching Day tonight. I don't even plan on seeing him. He'll know exactly where the 10-second place is, and that I'm either an agent sent by the government or by the black market dealers that pay taxes to the government. He's not going to show his face. Even Commander Jameson, who's testing me with this first task, knows we won't get a glimpse of him. But I know he's going to be there. He needs plague meds desperately enough. And him showing up is all I hope for tonight. A clue, a starting point, a narrower direction, something personal about this boy criminal. I'm careful not to walk under the street lamps. In fact, I would have traveled by rooftop if I weren't going to the financial sector, where guards line the roofs. All around me, the jumbotrons blare their colorful campaigns, the sound of their ads distorted and jolty from the city speakers. One of them shows an updated profile of Day, this time featuring a boy with long black hair. Next to the jumbotrons are flickering streetlights, and under those walk crowds of night shift workers, police, and merchants. Every now and then, a tank rolls through, followed by several platoons of troops. They have blue stripes on their sleeves, soldiers back from the war front, or soldiers rotating out to the war front. They keep their guns by their sides with both hands on the weapon. They all look like Mateus to me, and I have to breathe a little harder, walk a little faster, anything to stay focused. I take the long way through Batala, through the sector's side roads and abandoned buildings, not stopping until I'm a good distance outside of military grounds. The street police won't know I'm on a mission. If they see me dressed like this, equipped with infrared goggles, they'll question me for sure. The Arcadia Bank lies on a quiet street. I go around the bank's backside until I'm standing in front of a parking lot at the end of an alleyway. There, I wait in the shadows. My goggles wash most of the color out of the scene. I look around and see rows of city speakers on the roofs, a stray cat whose tail twitches over the lid of a trash can, an abandoned kiosk with old anti-colonies bulletins tacked all over it. The clock on my visor says 11:53 p.m. I pass the time by forcing myself to think through Day's history.
Before the robbery at this bank, Day had already appeared on our records 3 times. Those were only the incidents where we found fingerprints. I can only guess at the number of other crimes he's committed. I take a closer look at the bank's alleyway. How did he break into this bank in 10 seconds, with 4 armed guards at the back entrance? The alley is narrow. He could have found enough footholds to jump his way up to the walls to the 2nd or 3rd floors, all while using the guards' weapons against them. Probably got them to shoot at each other. Probably smashed through a window. That would have taken just a few seconds. What he did once he got inside, I have no idea. I already know how agile Day is. Surviving a 2.5-story fall proves that much. He won't have a chance to do that tonight, though. I don't care how light he is on his feet. You don't just jump out of buildings and then expect to be able to walk properly afterwards. Day won't be scampering up walls and stairwells for at least another week. Suddenly, I tense up. It's 12:02 a.m. A clicking sound echoes from somewhere far away, and the cat sitting on the trash can makes a run for it. It could be a cigarette lighter, a gun trigger, the speakers, or a flickering streetlight. It could be anything. I scan the roofs. Nothing yet. But the hairs on the back of my neck rise. I know he's here. I know he's watching me. "Come out," I say. The tiny microphone at my mouth makes my voice sound like a man's. Silence. Not even the kiosk's layers of paper bulletins move. There's no wind tonight. I remove a vial from a holster at my belt. My other hand doesn't leave the handle of my gun. "I have what you need," I say, and wave around the vial for emphasis. Still nothing. This time, however, I hear what sounds like the faintest sigh. A breath. My eyes dart to the speakers lining the roofs. That's what the clicking sound was. He's rewired the speakers so he can talk to me without giving away his location. I smile behind my mask. It's what I would have done. "I know you need this," I say, gesturing again at the vial. I turn it in my hands and hold it higher. "It has all its official labels, the stamp of approval. I assure you it's the real thing." Another breath. "Someone you care about will wish you'd come out to greet me." I look at the time on my goggles. "It's 12:05. I'll give you 2 minutes, then I leave." The alley falls silent again. Every now and then, I hear another faint breath from the loudspeakers. My eyes shift from the time on my visor to the shadows of the roofs. He's clever. I can't tell where he's broadcasting from. It could be on this street. It could be several blocks down from a higher floor. But I know he's close enough to see me himself. The time on my visor shows 12:07. I turn, tuck the vial back into my belt, and start to walk away.
"What do you want for the cure, cousin?"
The voice is barely a whisper, but through the speakers it sounds broken and startling, so crackly that I have trouble understanding him. Details race instantly through my mind. Male. He has a light accent. He's not from Oregon or Nevada or Arizona or New Mexico or West Texas or any